The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Well, I have some notes that you're welcome to follow along with me. We will appeal to these regularly as we pursue it. And if you would like to have a free copy or take some along for others back in the year 2001, when the 300th anniversary of Penn's charter in Philadelphia was being celebrated, actually wasn't even being paid attention to, and I had a chance to say, why aren't we paying attention to this great event? We had a celebration. I wrote a little book, and some of the things I'm going to talk about are far more fully pursued here, although many of the things are not here, so you might want to pick that up. There's a box of those. You're welcome to them. So it is indeed a great privilege to be with you today, and I would ask you to follow along with me. As you know, there's an oxymoron that describes the Western civilization that we're part of. It's called the Wars of Religion. The Wars of Religion were exactly what they say. People's religious views brought political powers clashing with others. The word religio means a binding together, and a war is tearing someone apart. The wars of religion are not new. They go back very far in history. And a classic place to begin are the words that John Milton, the great Puritan poet, gave us as he tried to describe what happened to the Waldensians in the Alps Mountains. I had the joy of being with Bill at an ancient Waldensian church just not so many months ago when we were traveling outside of Aix-en-Provence. But I can't do full justice to the poetry, but let me read it because it gives us a little taste. Avenge, O Lord, thy slaughtered saints whose bones lie scattered on the Alpine mountains cold. Even them who kept thy truth so pure of old when all our fathers worshiped stocks and stones. Forget not, in thy book record their groans who were thy sheep and in their ancient fold slain by the bloody Piedmontese that rolled mother with infant down the rocks. Their moans, the veils redoubled to the hills and they to heaven. Their martyred blood and ashes so o'er the Italian fields were still to sway the triple tyrant, that from these may grow a hundredfold, who having learnt thy way, early may fly the Babylonian woe. Those are powerful words. They're the power of church and state coming together against a group of believers that were considered unworthy of the judgment of the powers of the Triple Crown. As we consider that, we realize that this was an era where cuius regio eius religio was enforced. His region, his religion. The only conscience that was permitted was that of the one who was in ascendancy. No one else's conscience mattered. Now, we know there are many sources for the ideas of protecting the conscience. One, indeed, were the Huguenots. There's a marvelous work that's important because it was written in part against our own beloved John Calvin. Now that's painful to have to admit. But Calvin was not inerrant, even though he was the greatest genius the Reformed Church has probably ever produced after Cornelius Van Til, John Murray, and Bill Edgar. Okay. But you know, he's quite up there. But we realize that Castellio, if you turn to page 2, a marvelous quote, only 4 copies of this book still exist. It was considered heresy at the time and destroyed by fellow Reformed people and others. A Huguenot, let's say a Frenchman, Reformed in that sense, says, I find that the principal and effective cause of your malady, O desolate France, that's the name of the title, that is to say the sedition and war which torment you, is the forcing of consciences. As one had for a long time forced and tried to force the consciences of the evangelics, they themselves in their treaty entered into at Orléans stressed sufficiently clearly that they are fighting for religion. And it goes on to say, as such, one must conclude that the cause of this war is the forcing of consciences. And so we are truly appreciative of the groundbreaking work of historically minded Reformed people such as the Puritans, who began to develop the theology of the liberty of conscience. We can find William Perkins, William Ames, and John Owen, all within the general maelstrom of Puritanism addressing the liberty of conscience. And ultimately, as that comes to the pen of the Westminster Assembly, we find these words: God alone is the Lord of the conscience, and hath left it free from the doctrines and commandments of men which are in anything contrary to his word or beside it in matters of faith or worship. When we hear those striking words at that moment in history, it is indeed something of a contradiction to recognize that the Puritans wanted this kind of liberty of conscience, but were not always prepared to share it with others who came under their hegemony. And so we recognize that that same confession will say in 23:3, words of coercive power are appropriately to be given to the magistrate when it comes to matters of religion and conscience. The original Westminster Confession will say, civil magistrates may not assume to themselves the administration of the word and sacraments, or the power of the keys of the kingdom of heaven, or in the least interfere in matters of faith. Yeah, as nursing fathers, it is the duty of civil magistrates to protect the church of our common Lord without giving the preference to any denomination of Christians above the rest. Now, those words are wonderful, aren't they? That's religious liberty. It will go on to say, according to their own professions and belief. If you just turn over a couple of the next page, at the top of the page, you'll hear what the original said in 1647. What we've read is the American version, and this is what would have been closer to Calvin and part of the original confession. The civil magistrate may not assume to himself the administration of the word and sacraments or the power of the keys of the kingdoms of heaven. So far, so much, agreed. But notice what it now says. Yet he hath authority, and it is his duty to take order that unity and peace be preserved in the church, that the truth of God be kept pure and entire, that all blasphemies and heresies be suppressed, all corruptions and abuses in worship and discipline prevented or reformed, and all the ordinances of God duly settled, administered, and observed, for the better effecting whereof he hath power to call synods, to be present at them, and to provide that whatsoever is transacted in them be according to the mind of God. Imagine if you are a presbyter that shows up at Presbyterian gatherings, called presbytery meetings, about one out of every three or four, and the state is there at every one saying, if you don't show up, your taxes are going up. How would you like that? That's part of the history of the teaching of our confession. The power of, if you will, the state to impose it. Well, we don't have time to look at the next paragraph, the subnote, where it says the whole story of Servetus and Calvin. Again, the intricacies of that are important to keep in mind. Calvin did not put someone to death, but he did speak theologically in favor of it. That we realize that Castellio and others in that debate said, once Calvin said it's wrong to put a person to death because of his faith. But then when he came to power in Geneva, he reversed his opinion. How about that? Later, Reformed people put up expiatory statues to say, forgive us, Lord, for our failure to understand how people's consciences must be protected. Now, there are different reasons for the movement in the direction in the Westminster tradition for developing the liberty of conscience. Certainly, as we heard today, the nonconformist in England, that was a key part. Perhaps just the very experience of America, it has always been a hodgepodge, if you will, of different faiths coming together from all over the world. One writer puts it this way, quoting a historical letter: New York has first a chaplain belonging to the fort of the Church of England, secondly a Dutch Calvinist, thirdly a French Calvinist, fourthly a Dutch Lutheran. There may not be many of the Church of England, few Roman Catholics, abundance of Quaker preachers, men and women especially, singing Quakers, ranting Quakers, Sabbatarians, anti-Sabbatarians, some Anabaptists, some Jews in sort. Of all sorts of opinion, there are some, and the most part, none at all. Well, when John Witherspoon will be in power as a Scottish Presbyterian, who is also signer of the American Declaration of Independence, one of the early presidents of Princeton, he will see that religious liberty is built into the American version of the Westminster Confession of Faith. The question is, what happened? How did they get there? How did this change come about to make our confession in America reflect some of the distinctives of America? Well, a classic explanation of the specific details is found at the top of page 4. James H. Smiley, editor of the Journal of Presbyterian History, wrote in the 1974 version of that particular journal, "Since 1729, the Westminster Confession of Faith and the larger and shorter catechisms had been the confessional standards of American Presbyterianism. When the General Assembly constituted itself, the commissioners did not deliberate long on alterations. The standards were altered in those places which provided for the freedom of the denomination from the interference by the civil authority. Thus the words, quote, and by the power of the civil magistrate, end of quote, were dropped from chapter 24:4. And 31:2, giving the civil magistrate power to call synods, was dropped altogether. The commissioners rewrote completely chapter 23:3 on the relation of the civil magistrate to the administration of the word and sacrament and the keys of the kingdom. Presbyterians deleted from the larger catechism, question 109, the quote, tolerating a false religion, end of quote, was a sin against the second commandment. The significance of these changes may be seen by comparing the standards at these points to what they were in 1729. The question then is, how did it come about that 2 or 3 years before the First Amendment was ratified and adopted in America as the first of the Bill of Rights, that the Presbyterian Confession had already stated a view of religious liberty, the liberty of conscience, the protection of different sects and faiths by the government? How did they get there first? What prompted them to do that so that when the First Amendment came along, they understood it and were in favor of it? Well, the difference is the movement from the old world to the new. And while we could tell a great deal about that story, I just wanted to summarize it because it's a whole course of study that we cannot possibly do justice to. So what I've done instead, starting at the bottom of page 4, to give you some of the key dates, and I'd like to along the way just highlight a few elements that will help us to appreciate what occurred. In 1560, of course, John Knox's leadership brought about the Scots Confession of Faith, and Scottish Presbyterianism was confessionally born. We move along several years and we find the epoch of Charles I in England coming to the throne. And as you turn the page, you realize from the date 1637 almost down to the bottom of page 5, 1689, is the story of the Westminster Assembly and the aftermath of there being an estate religion called Presbyterianism and then the removal thereof and the return back to the monarchy. I won't address any of that because that was the great lecture that's already been going on by someone who knows that history far better than ever I would claim to do. But what we need to see as we come to the bottom of page 5, at 1689, the Act of Toleration is finally passed in England. There are now Protestant monarchs, William and Mary, ascending to the throne, and they are leading. And we come to a date, which we will just ask you to consider on page 9, appendix 2, which is the year of 1701, where we find William Penn and the establishment of Pennsylvania. The story of Penn, if you'd like to know it, in some summary form, is one of the things that I share in this book that I've offered for you if you'd like to have. But will you notice at the top of page 9, as Penn is describing now his constitution and his proprietary colony, as one who had been in jail because of his conscience, he'd been in the Tower of London, he now is able to have a land that's his own, the size of the state of Pennsylvania, to set up its own laws and its own rules. And he will begin and end his charter with remarkable words about the conscience. At the top of page 9 it says, "Because no people can be truly happy, though under the greatest enjoyments of civil liberties if abridged of the freedom of their consciences." He'll go on to say that there will be free exercise of religion. No one will be restricted. If you believe, he said, you needed to be a monotheist, whatever form it took, you were free here. He will make it clear he wanted Christians to be in government, but he would not shut down any worship. Did you know that there was a point in English history where the only place in the entire English-speaking world where people could be Roman Catholics and be English citizens and operate openly was in the city of Philadelphia? Every place else in the world, it was shut down. Here it could not. Penn's charter protected them. But notice at the end of the second paragraph, this is now the ending, after he goes through his entire constitutional description, right in the middle of the paragraph, the word "but." "But because the happiness of mankind descends so much upon the enjoying of liberty of their conscience, as aforesaid, He goes on and says, I repeat it again. He starts and ends by saying the liberty of conscience is what we must have if people are going to be truly happy in their religious liberties in America. Now, if you want to turn over to page 10 for just a moment, look at the top of page 10, the quote that's indented. It says, this is now the state of Georgia. It says, and for their greater ease and encouragement of our loving subjects and such others who shall come to inhabit in our said colony, we do grant, establish, and ordain that forever hereafter there shall be a liberty of conscience allowed in the worship of God to all persons within our said province, and that all such persons, except papists, shall have a free exercise of religion. Okay? An excluded group. Now you could change that to Presbyterian, or you could change that to Anabaptist. The government says, we tell you if you have rights or not, your conscience is valued or not. We must confess that Pennsylvania had grown in a tremendous direction. One of the stories you need to know, and I can't tell it because of our time here today, is that William Penn discovered his first inklings of religious liberty through the Huguenots in France, where he studied and lived in the home of Moses Amiro in Saumur. It's a fascinating moment in history, and he saw it in action for the first time under Henry IV. But be that as it may, religious liberty now, as we turn back to page 5 to our schedule of dates, becomes a reality because of the act of toleration generally, and very specifically in Pennsylvania because of Penn's charter. That meant that Presbyterians began to recognize that they had some hope of liberty in England, but even far more in the New World. And so we begin to see by 1706, just 5 years after Penn's final version of his charter, there are enough Presbyterians in America to organize the first presbytery. They came here. Remember, what confession did they bring? That we want the magistrate to be able to suppress those who have heresy. Okay, did they think that everybody, every state that they had was legitimate? If you look again at the chart that was there on the previous page, you'll find that no state had an established Presbyterian church. They were a minority. Their confession called for the magistrate to enforce the truth. And so their hope was is that they would one day grow and be able to impose the truth on everybody else. That was part of the tradition of what we would call the magisterial reformation. Under their experience of liberty, especially in Pennsylvania, in the region of Delaware, Pennsylvania, the PCA Presbytery is called the Heritage Presbytery because it's the seat of the earliest Presbyterian meetings. Middle Octorara, we're going to talk about that church in a minute, out there in Chester County, the early churches that came here, they grew because no one was stopping them. They had religious liberty. By 1716, the first Presbyterian Synod is organized. In 1717, emigration from Ireland and Scotland intensifies as they feel the persecution, even under the liberties that they had. They were only tolerated. They were not fully free. There's a fascinating letter that comes from 1729 I quote here for you. It says this, the Presbyterian ministers have taken their share of pains to seduce their poor, ignorant hearers by bellowing from their pulpits against the landlords and the clergy. Now, this letter is being written to explain how come so many people are leaving Ireland and going to America. So the preachers are preaching, and they're attacking the landlords and clergy, calling them rackers of rents and screwers of tithes, with other reflections of this nature, which they know is pleasing to their people. At the same time telling them that God had appointed a country for them to dwell in, naming New England, and desires them to depart thence, where they will be freed from the bondage of Egypt and go to the land of Canaan. The clergy in England were saying, go to the promised land of America, where you will be free from the bondage of Anglican, Episcopalian influences. The church continues to grow so that by 1729, the Adopting Act occurs, and the American Presbyterians adopt the Westminster Standard, still with the unchanged version that gives the power of calling the synod into the hands of the magistrate and affirming that blasphemy is under his control. The Great Awakening, as you know, occurs in 1720-50, and during that time there's the great division between the new side and old side. And in the midst of that, in a remarkable book written by Jonathan Edwards, Some Thoughts Concerning the Present Revival of Religion in New England, the Great Awakening is breaking out, and Edwards is trying to explain it. And I want to read just a couple paragraphs here. They're again on page 6 of your notes. It says, as there is the clearest evidence from those things that have been observed that this is the work of God, so it is evident that it is a very great and wonderful, exceeding glorious work of God. This is certain, that it is a great and wonderful event, a strange revolution, an unexpected, surprising overturning of things, suddenly brought to pass, such as never has been seen in New England and scarce ever has been heard of in any land. It is not unlikely that this work of God's Spirit that is so extraordinary and wonderful is the dawning, or at least a prelude to that glorious work of God, so often foretold in Scripture, which in the progress and issue of it shall renew the world of mankind. And there are many things that make it probable that this work will begin in America. To signify that it shall begin in some very remote part of the world, that the rest of the world have no communication with it, but by navigation, for example, in Isaiah 60 and verse 9, he begins to defend that this post-millennial dream that he sees in Isaiah is being fulfilled in America. And that's part of the new Great Awakening. That's part of the New School Presbyterianism. Presbyterians are burgeoning in numbers through immigrants. And many sides, on the New School side, they are burgeoning in numbers as people are coming to faith, and they have a post-millennial vision. Their post-millennial vision is part of the hope of the grace of God promised in Scripture. Now, not everybody agreed with that. Take a look at what happens in 1743. There's a gentleman by the name of Alexander Craighead, and he is one who believes that the Scottish covenants must be renewed, the Solemn League and Covenant. And so in Middle Octorara, Pennsylvania, he renews the Scottish covenants with swords drawn. They stand out in the churchyard with swords pointing north, south, east, and west, and they reestablish the covenant. And he gives, quote, the declaration, protestation, and testimony of a suffering remnant of the anti-popish, anti-Lutherian, anti-prelatic, anti-Erastian, anti-latitudinarian, I don't know how you can say this, anti-sectarian, true Presbyterian Church of Christ in America. Now, don't you wish that was the title for your denomination? Boy, you could say it all just right out front. That's who we are. Okay? You know, his complaint also was against the Presbyterians who dared support the Adopting Act of 1729 because it didn't have the full Scottish League and Covenant commitment in it. So now we begin to see in the Great Awakening and with the immigrations, still with the confession unchanged, two approaches, basically one of the revival and one of the what would be a reflection of maybe the most strict of the old school as you could get, saying we're going back to the beginning. In that milieu, however, there continues to be an unfolding of the church. Finally, 1746, the College of New Jersey is formed by Presbyterians. That will become the Great School of Princeton in time. 1752, 1757, another key development, what's called the Independent Reflector. This is a magazine published in New York by three Presbyterians, one of whom was from Huguenot descent. The purpose was to argue that the state church in New York was unacceptable for Presbyterians. They were not required to passively just accept that, that they ought to resist it if it reflected tyranny. How about that? They saw that they had a right to resist the power of the bishops that were being developed through the Anglican establishment. They were not to simply be passive obedience and non-resistance people if they saw it as spiritual tyranny. Well, the French and Indian War will break out, the Seven-Year War in which the Americans and the English will fight the French. And it's the next year of its breaking out, the old side and new side come together. Undoubtedly, they wanted to have a united front against an enemy. They also recognized the new school had burgeoned inside and the old school was shriveling in numbers. And so they came together. And in that context, then, we have the great preaching of a man named Samuel Davies, who will also become a president of Princeton. But one of the great sermons he will preach is that a patriot and a Christian, when they're both at their best, are one and the same. He has a great sermon that was published. In that sermon will be the one where he will give the prophecy of the young George Washington. Do you remember the Battle of Braddock's defeat when all the officers are killed except Washington? And Samuel Davies will say, we will hope that God's providence has spared this young colonel for some future great leadership in his nation. Well, that's been looked at back and said, little did they understand how prophetic he was. Well, this is a Presbyterian preaching as a dissenter in Anglican Virginia, saying that you need to stand against the enemy of your country as a Presbyterian, preaching from the pulpit. And you need to even stand up and defend the government, which has you as a dissenter. You are to be involved in resistance for the sake of good order. American Presbyterians are growing. They've now come together. They see an enemy, and they believe it's appropriate for them to take up the sword on behalf of their magistrate. And so as they continue to go forward, what will happen next is that the English influence after the war will begin to put more pressure on America to consecrate a bishop for all of America. Imagine America never had their own bishop. There's now going to be an American episcopacy established. Presbyterians join together with all the other dissenters and say, we don't want that here. They are fighting. What are they crying out for? What they had already enjoyed, liberty of conscience. But yet they recognized, in principle, their confession said the magistrate is supposed to suppress heresy. But they are resisting what they saw as inappropriate theology. The stamp crisis occurs, and we won't go into revolutionary American history, but you remember that brought all the colonies together. And at the end of it, in 1766, the Synod, now the old school, new school united, declare that Presbyterians together should thank God for the repeal of the Stamp Act, that civil events are worshipful concerns of the church. They are celebrating government action. And so they will. We now know that this will continue to unfold. The Townshend Acts, other things, we won't go into history again. Hopefully you review that on your own. But in 1768, Witherspoon, Scottish Presbyterian, comes now to Princeton, president of the College of New Jersey, and he begins to teach. I give you a little taste of it in some of your notes here in a moment. You can read it in the back of your pack here if you'd like to see a little taste of Witherspoon's writings. But he will have an influence on various leaders of future America, one of whom will be James Madison, who actually came to study for religion initially. But he will learn a great deal about religious persecution and become an advocate, as others, such as Thomas Jefferson in Virginia, against the persecution of minorities. 1769, and now this is an interesting point. I want to slow down for just a minute. There's a gentleman by the name of Alexander McDougall, a Presbyterian, who become actively associated with a group called the Sons of Liberty. Do you remember the people that met in Boston that hung the leaders of England in effigy? They said, let's don't have Pope's Day anymore. Let's have the king being dragged. I shouldn't say the king quite yet. His ministers being dragged through the street in effigy. The gunpowder plot was now turned against the new leaders, if you will, and they protested that from the past. But what happens is that as people deal with this kind of radical movement, they begin to say, those are Presbyterians. Those aren't just any old Americans, they're Presbyterians. Now, I want to show you this. If you turn to the back of your notes, a couple pages that I give you, they're unnumbered, and they are collected from the one of the journals of the Presbyterian history. It's right after page 12. You see at the bottom? It says, Benjamin Prime celebrates the Sons of Liberty. Benjamin Prime was the son of a Presbyterian minister, and one of the great songs of the Son of Liberty was written by a Presbyterian, one of their marching songs, if you will. It says, in story we're told how our fathers of old braved the rage of the wind and the waves and crossed the deep oar to this desolate shore, all because they were loath to be slaves, brave boys, all because they were loath to be slaves. There's about maybe 15 stanzas. This only gives you about 8 of them. You can see the Presbyterians were beginning to be involved in political activities, wanting to have religious liberty. And when there was a protest, the very back of your packet, if you'll turn to that, you'll see the resolves of the true Sons of Liberty. This is now a broadside. A broadside was the way you got back at your opponents, like all these political signs that are all over, you know. A certain president must go, okay? Put in the name, whoever you want. That's the protest. Well, they were broadside. And so there were broadsides that were being published against the true Sons of Liberty. And you notice who signs it? John Calvin, John Knox, and Roger Rumpus. Now, the protest is not immediate. This is a farce. It's a mockery. They're pretending as though John Calvin, John Knox, and whoever Roger Rumpus might be wrote this in July 1774. Notice, if you want to look at an interesting conclusion, at number 15 at the bottom, just one among many. You can read these on your own. Resolve lastly that every man, woman, or child who doth not agree with our sentiments. So this is now the Sons of Liberty allegedly writing this broadside. who doth not agree with our sentiments, whether he, she, or they understand them or not, is an enemy to his country, wherever soever he was born, and a Jacobite in principle, whether he may think of it, and that he ought at least to be tarred and feathered, if not hanged, drawn and quartered, all statutes, laws, and ordinance whatsoever to the contrary notwithstanding. Okay, point is, these Presbyterians are really totally committed to their position. Nobody has any rights but them. That's fascinating. That's the way they saw them. Okay, now, what do we do with all of this as this unfolds? Well, let's go back to our outline of the dates, and we build to a point here. As the Boston Massacre unfolds, and then the Boston Tea Party, there begins to be a need for a united front in America, a need for everyone to say, can we stand against Episcopalians? Can we stand against Roman Catholics? Can we stand against Anabaptists? We are facing an enemy that's bigger than all of us. Now, the Sons of Liberty were often accused as being Presbyterian, but the whole battle for America wasn't now just a group called the Sons of Liberty, it's the entire country that comes together. They are fighting for their rights, and what we will find now, if you turn to Appendix 3, which will be found on page 10, we discover something that creates a unity of mind among the dissenters in the face of the power of the British pressure against the Americans who are protesting their rights that draws them together in a whole new way. Okay, it's not any longer Presbyterian, Episcopalian, true order of worship, false order of worship, true confession, false confession. What we find is that there is something called the Quebec Act. You find it right here in your under Appendix 3. Let me read it there on page 10. It says, these are the rights you, speaking to the people of Quebec, are entitled to and not at this moment in perfection to exercise. And what is offered to you by the last act of Parliament in their place? Liberty of conscience in your religion? No. God gave it to you and the temporal powers with which you have been and are connected firmly stipulated for your enjoyment of it. Now, we won't read it all, but notice right at the bottom of that quote, right before the data of citation, it will say, as far as they could be by Parliament to establish even the Inquisition itself among you. Now, what's happened? What is the Act of Quebec? Basically, what had happened in the aftermath of the Seven-Year War, Quebec was given religious liberty to establish a Roman Catholic power in Canada. They gave great freedoms to the Roman Catholic people to build their government and, if necessary, even establish a religious government with sword and faith side by side in the hands of the magistrate. On the other side of the wilderness were the ancient free Protestant colonies of New England. And in the other colonies all across the seaboard of America, the dissenters had no rights before the crown, like the Roman Catholics had been given. They saw it simultaneously as giving to the Roman Catholics freedom to establish the Inquisition over their own subjects and to take up the sword to attack Protestants. And they would not even give the same rights to fellow Protestants. In the wake of that, Americans come together and they begin to call themselves Protestants. In each of the quotes, and we won't read them all, but let me just cite a few words. It will say, for example, in the second quote, that we must preserve these civil and religious rights and liberties for which many of our fathers fought. The next one says, it is dangerous in an extreme degree to the Protestant religion and to the civil rights and liberties. At the top of page 11, you see the very first words, Protestant Christians. The bottom of the next quote, in the second line to the end of the quote, free Protestant colonies. The next one, to establish a religion fraught with sanguinary and impious tenets, that's Catholicism, with the use of the sword. And on it goes. At this point in history, something is beginning to happen among our Presbyterian brethren in America. They begin to say, we are Presbyterians. We believe the magistrate, by confession, has the power to impose our faith on others. But if we hold to ourselves separate from everyone else, we will not survive. If there's a power from Canada coming down or the power from England coming over and they find a higher level of unity, it was called, we are Protestants. We have a common faith that's not the same. They created, if you will, you may not like the word, but it's basically a civil religion. It was the Protestant civil religion that brought them together in 1774 right here in Philadelphia at a place called Carpenter's Hall. So what happens as we go forward? The Presbyterians fight alongside with the Anglicans that are willing to stand with America, like George Washington, Episcopalian, the New Englanders, like John Adams, a Congregationalist, the Lutherans, like Muhlenberg, as Protestants. And at the end of that long battle for American struggle, we come back to our outline on page 7, and we just final out the thoughts here. 1778, something very interesting happens. America and France create an allegiance. They were Roman Catholics. Where they were afraid of Roman Catholicism in Canada, they've now moved to the point of survival that they actually say, we have to not say that the Catholics are always all bad. We have to link up with the Roman Catholics. And so now, they're now finding a union that's even greater. It's not religious union, but it's a union for survival. And so if go back to 1776 in your notes, and there are a couple key things I want you to see here. When the Declaration of Independence is declared in America, there are four references to deity there. They're all consistent in general with Christian thought. But what's important is that there's a group of Presbyterians in Virginia in a town called Hanover. And that presbytery establishes a statement that I don't give you in full text here, but it's, if I had had time, I would have put it in. But it basically says this, that we recognize that if the state is able to establish a government of any kind, all the arguments that you could use to establish a government would equally hold to establishing the Muslim faith. And if you have any arguments that will establish that that's not true, it at least will be sufficient to say that you could establish any other religion such as Catholicism. And their conclusion is, the Hanover Presbytery in Virginia, as dissenters, saying that we think government should not be in the religion business. That was not their confession. Their confession said, the magistrate is to take care of blasphemy. He can call synods. And the Hanover Presbytery said, no. The year of our independence, that's the first clear statement I've come across of a body that will say, we will not have established religion. That was not their creed, but it was their practice and faith in their smaller creed in that context. Now, when the Revolutionary War had been completed, after all the things that it had gone through, America in 1783 will give thanks and celebrate as a people. In 1787, it is very fascinating that in Philadelphia, the meeting place for the Constitutional Assembly, the same year, the same city, will be where the Presbyterians come together to plan their General Assembly under the leadership of John Witherspoon. In 1788, the next year, Presbyterians amend the confessional standards to establish the freedom of the church from the civil magistrate. And the next year, they have, if you will, their first General Assembly. And then 2 years thereafter, the Bill of Rights will be passed, and Presbyterians are already there. So what do we make of all of this story? It seems to me that our confession was written by theologians in America, but they didn't get there by way of biblical exegesis first. They got there by way of reality. And they wrote a statement that said, we need each other. We must protect each other if we will survive. So what is their final thought? Let's go back and look at it with care, and then this is where we'll finish. And if you have questions, comments, disagreements, they'll be fine. Let's take a look at page 4 again. Right in the middle of the page, you hear the words of our First Amendment that says, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievances. Now, those are the words of our Constitution. These are the words of our American Presbyterian Constitution as it was rewritten. Civil magistrates may not assume to themselves the administration of the word and sacraments. Presbyterians have always believed something of what we can call sphere sovereignty. The church cannot be the state cannot be the church. Calvin believed that. That's in both confessions. It says, are the power of the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Church discipline ultimately does not belong to the state, or in the least interfere in matters of faith. Oh, how about that? They cannot interfere in matters of faith. They do have an interest. The state should be as a nursing father, like a father with a brand new baby protecting his child. He is to protect the church of our common Lord without giving the preference to any denomination of Christians above the rest. The kind of government that they wanted now was one that did not protect Anglicans because there's an established church. And they said, we as Presbyterians don't want to be an established church. We don't believe that. We want to have government separate from the church, but a very friendly separation, one in which the magistrate is a nursing father, caring for all the churches to benefit them in such a manner that all ecclesiastical persons, whatever, even Roman Catholics, even the heretic Unitarians, all ecclesiastical persons, whatever, shall enjoy the full, free, and unquestioned liberty of discharging every part, including the Mass, of their sacred functions without violence or danger. The magistrate, if he's a Presbyterian in power, must make sure that the Catholic can celebrate the Mass without being bothered. That's what our confession came. That was not the position when they came to America. Okay? And as Jesus Christ hath appointed a regular government and discipline in his church, there is to be discipline in the church, no law of any commonwealth should interfere with, let, or hinder. They should stay out of the way of each church's doing its own disciplinary task in the due exercise thereof among the voluntary members of any denomination of Christians according to their own profession and belief. It is the duty of civil magistrates to protect the person and good name of all their people in such an effectual manner as that no person be suffered, either upon pretense of religion or of infidelity, to offer any indignity, violence, abuse, or injury to any other person whatsoever, and to take order that all religious and ecclesiastical assemblies be held without molestation or disturbance. Religious liberty is now to be practiced. The government is to make sure it's there and give support so that all of their rights will be guaranteed. What does that mean for us historically, and what does it mean for us practically? And then you can have some shots at whatever you'd like. Historically, it means that the confession was not amended because they said it's something that we think is wrong initially. It's something that they learned to recognize was not true. And then they went back and wrestled with it. This is an experiential, that the evidence shows it came about out of their own experience, their own benefit. I don't know if that has any practice or relevance for us. That's scary to think about, too. But as we look at our confession, is it possible that there are things that we believe in our confession that ought to be retested by reality? I'm not saying that there are, but that's part of the American experience, for good or for bad, to say, this isn't working anymore. Is that really true? Okay, bottom line, I would like to say practically, the reason I care about this study is to balance the two sides. One is, as Presbyterians, we need to recognize that the government ought not in any way to impinge upon our rights. We should have complete freedom, freedom of speech in anything, including issues of sexuality and the family. On the other hand, that when we are involved in the state, we should expect the state to deal with us as nursing fathers. When the state is hostile to us, we should not be indifferent about that. When a child has a father that no longer cares for it, it cries, it complains, it protests. I believe our very system requires us to say we ought not to see church and state one and the same, but it is a friendly separation. And when it becomes hostile, we have reason to complain. So that is what has motivated me personally to be an activist, because I think we have a hostile government against Presbyterian faith. Did you know that just this week there were people that were simply saying that homosexuality is incorrect and there's a better way on a street corner, and the power of the state has put them in jail, and they said they started a riot. That's in America. That's in Philadelphia. And there are 40 years of potential prison time that this humble group of evangelists are facing, and they didn't even start a riot. They didn't fight anybody. They just spoke their faith humbly using free speech. That's not Canada now. That's not Sweden. That's right here in this city where it all began. Okay, I think we need to go back and look again and say, what does our faith say? All right, you can respond any way you'd like.
Let's go to about three, so we don't wear Peter out. So I don't think he ever does wear out. And I'm just going to be the timekeeper here. You know, why don't you just
okay.
Field the questions?
Okay. Questions, comments, debate. Yes, sir. There was tremendous interplay between them because of the Virginia context primarily. In Virginia, there were a whole host of Baptists and there were a whole host of Presbyterians, both of which were under the direct oversight of the established Anglican Church of Virginia. And so in many cases, they came together to complain about the requirement to pay for the glebes. You know, that was a big farm you're paying for the local Anglican pastor. You had to pay tithes. You were paying for the church's schools and life, and they were teaching things contrary to your very faith. And so they often would find themselves protesting. A classic example of that is a court case where the famous man, Patrick Henry, who said, "Give me liberty or give me death." You may recall that. He was a Presbyterian. His pastor for part of his life was Samuel Davies, this man that we mentioned earlier. And he actually, as an attorney, went into a case to defend Baptists that were being persecuted by the church courts, and he had actually successfully defended them. So Presbyterians and Baptists were side by side crying out for religious liberty in that era of dissent. So they did work together, at least in those early years. They'd fight about baptism, they'd fight about all sorts of church government, but they both agreed that the religious liberty they longed for should be given to both. Well, let's put it this way. Baptists have always been a minority. And so that they developed early on, except for a brief blip in Europe when the Anabaptists conquered a couple cities and then got utterly devastated, the Mennonites came out of that. They've always been pacifists. They tended to run away, and then when the Baptist movement picked up some of the Reformed and Mennonite ideas, they always saw themselves as a non-governmental church. They had no magisterial views. And so from the beginning, they began to develop ideas of religious toleration. In fact, the earliest book that was printed in the English language on religious liberty is from a Baptist pen. I actually quote that in one of the appendices in this book back here. I've forgotten the exact year now. But so, yes, I would say that the Presbyterians, as they came from Scotland, had an established church. They came as minorities. They wanted religious liberty, but they quite well have thought someday we'll be in charge here because they were growing and had those ideas. And I think the experience of working together, plus the wisdom of the necessary working together, maybe understanding more of the body, life, and things of Scripture, I think they began to influence each other in different ways. So the Baptists in America early on were very Reformed. The Philadelphia Confession of Faith is very Reformed. And some of the ideas of religious liberty of the Presbyterians is very much like what the early Baptists also pled for. So there is a real kind of symbiosis that occurs in those years. Some kind of a symbiotic relationship there. Yeah. Yes, sir, Tim. I would be comfortable to be corrected if you have the facts on that. My understanding is that he saw himself as a Presbyterian for at least part of his life, but that may have been necessary for him to have access to the bar, for example. I don't know, because there were points where. One of the things that was pointed out that if you wanted to make it in Virginia, you had to be part of the established church or you couldn't run for government.
Even after the war?
After the war, no. I think then that all changed all across the country. In let's say not in every state, but many states began to rewrite their laws that had restrictions. There was the famous memorial and remonstrance debate about the teachers of religion in Virginia. And that's where there's the classic writing of James Madison that occurs over that. And one of the things that we do know is that Washington, for example, who addresses this, says, "I really don't mind the government requiring payment for school teachers as long as there's relief for those that have a different view." If the Mohammedan, the Jew, or someone else says, "But if you're a Christian, it's going for general, what's the problem?" So he took the view it didn't matter. James Madison took the view it was really bad. And he opposed it with his great statement. And then I think if I remember the politics correctly, there was one vote that was going to determine which direction that debate went. And they knew where Patrick Henry stood. They knew that he was going to be in favor of the teaching of the Christian religion as long as there was relief. They elected him as governor that year so he couldn't vote. And that was actually part of the plan, as I understand it, that Patrick Henry said, Let's honor him and get him out of the vote, and he won't have the deciding vote. And so history might have been very different had Patrick Henry have been in arguing this case rather than having to do the moderating work as being the head of the government that year. So politics are still at work, aren't they? Church and state, yes. Yes, I think most of us would wish that all churches were as serious about this as the Presbyterian churches generally are. The black churches tend to have candidates in all the time and endorse people and that sort of thing. And the IRS code is the law of the land as it's applied. And so we're obliged, if we believe that the magistrate's under God, over the people for God's glory, as our confession teaches us, we have to say we have to follow the IRS code, like it or not. Many would say, no, but it makes good sense that politics should not enter into the pulpit of the church. So I personally believe it's a good thing. I just wish everybody abided by it. Now, I don't know that I heard your exact nuance of your question, though. Say it again so I address you exactly. Well, let's put it this way. Any church can endorse a candidate if they want, if they're willing to lose their IRS exemption status. They'll pay for it. You can say, all right, we're no longer a tax-exempt organization. I could see a church saying, we don't care anymore. We think we ought to. I think the position of the church in wisdom is saying that the kingdom of the world is never the kingdom of God, and it's always dangerous to identify fully with any party or any candidate in any moment. And that's why it's always best to pursue the moral issues that are there. You know, what are changeless? The idea of moral law says that God's word and his will is in history for us to know, and when we pursue that, we're honoring God. And so one party can honor it one year and be against it the next year. So we don't want to identify ourselves with any party. We want to identify ourselves with what does God expect for his church, and then ask people to reflect it. So, you know, the debate is one where when in the Civil War, for example, when the North said you need to stand against slavery as a moral responsibility, that divided the church. And that's why we have to be careful. Is that maybe it was right to have divided the church over that, but that's the cost we're going to have to look at. And I'm glad that churches generally in the biblical tradition don't identify candidates, not because of IRS laws. I mean, we got to honor those laws, but because they recognize that no human being and no earthly institution of government can ever be viewed as ultimately the messianic hope. And so we need to have the freedom to say, we kind of liked that guy last year, but boy, he's rotten. We better go this way, or we better have someone else run for it, a new party start or something. So I think the church needs to keep its integrity in that regard. Also, so let me give you follow up what you just said in this way. Every pastor, every elder, every deacon, every church member who's a real Christian is a member of two kingdoms, every moment of the day. And we have to live out consciously our duty in both. And so Jesus is King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and I need to honor him. And that means sometimes I'm for the incumbent, sometimes it means I'm not. And then if we recognize the principle of liberty, which was understood by our Puritan forefathers even before they got it all right, in my opinion, in regard to the magistrate, when the church starts preaching on these things, are we in danger of doing what our confession of binding the conscience, saying, you're sinning against God if you don't vote for this person? I think we ought to say much better is, again, as a private citizen debating to abbot, why are you not sinning? Explain to me. Defend your case. I think that's the way the kingdom of God goes forward much more boldly, is we debate it together and then we're responsible before God. You are responsible for your vote. Okay. Well, again, general statements are general statements, but it was, according to my understanding, is that when the American Revolution began to be described to King George of England, he said, well, we're going to have another Scotch-Irish rebellion in America. He understood Lex Rex Rutherford's thinking is that the magistrate does not rule by divine absolute right. They understood the covenantal character of power that came from the northern kingdom of Scotland. And so he saw that there was within there the idea that there's tyranny and there's justice. When there's justice, you have to honor the king. When there's tyranny, you can resist it. That's part of the Presbyterian Scottish tradition that came to America. And so by the end of the Revolutionary War, there was scarcely a Presbyterian who was not believing that King George was a tyrant, so that there was very little reason politically even to say, put the brakes on here. We've all fought together. We've all been together. So pragmatically, there was by and large a real commitment. They came into the battle as a minority, as dissenters by and large. They fought together and they had gained ground and they're elevated. The crown had kind of said, this is a Scotch-Irish rebellion. Americans, therefore, when they came together, saw America as a place where they were part of a bigger picture. So I would say in that kind of a general setting, there was very minimal debate. They had very little time in their confessional time when they sat down. They wrote it out very quickly, and it was basically agreed on. So the records did not show. I mean, I think about the time that we put in on some of our study committees in the PCA. Dave Kaufman could probably give you a whole history of these. You know, we spent maybe 10 years on some topics. What's our position? This is revolutionary, and they did it in, you know, a couple presbytery meetings, for all I know. That's how agreed they were. There was no debate on it. They just said, let's say who we are. This is what we've become. So we debate all sorts of things, and it takes us forever. They didn't do that. They did it quickly. They kind of understood where they stood. Okay, well, you've raised about 7 questions there. And if I answer wrong, I'll be defrocked, I think. So what do I say? Well, number one, I would say, for Jesus Christ to be declared openly as the King of Kings and Lord of Lords in this nation, it will take about 350 miracles, 350 million miracles, okay, of regeneration, where the free people. I think we could do that as a nation and say, we want Jesus to be the King here. In a Republican form of government, we are the government. And I think the question comes down to something like this. Do we want to use our power as citizens to bring that about? Well, if that's the case, it's not going to be through government. That's the church's role of evangelism. Wouldn't it be wonderful if the kind of awakening that Jonathan Edwards was speaking about, it's extraordinary. It's a revolution. Everything is overturned. It's never been like it before. We've got to pray for that. And then all of these sorts of things will kind of take care of themselves, because people say, well, we do want to have righteousness in the street. But yet on the other hand, okay, while we can't expect our president, I don't even think I'd want him to do it all the time. I'm a Christian. I'm speaking in the name of Jesus. Because, you know, when you speak that way, you're speaking intentionally to talk about the definitive character of the gospel. And in politics, it's not just about Christians. You do have to govern people that hate Christ. You have to lead the atheists. You have to lead the Muslims. But I want our president, if he's a Christian, to have the freedom to speak his First Amendment freedoms. I'm a Christian. I'm glad. If we ever have a Muslim president, I hope it doesn't happen. Forgive me for saying that. But if it does, he has to have the freedom to say, I'm a Muslim. That's part of what it means to be an American. Okay. Now, what can we do? Well, I think without binding the consciences, without confusing the spheres of church and state, I love that language of the nursing father. I think a child instantly begins to say, Daddy, where are you? You're not taking care of me. You promised, Daddy. That's a beautiful image of how the church ought to look to the state and say, we don't want you to trample on all of our brothers and sisters or our neighbors and take over. We want you to, you're the father of the whole family. But you're neglecting us, and you're abusing your children. And the church has a right to stand up and say, I don't want to be abused. And you're not. That's for your good. You shouldn't be doing that. And I think that's where we have a duty. I think our confession helps us greatly when it says God's moral law binds all people, not just Christians. It says even everybody, even the non-Christian, is under God's moral law. And so I think wisely, public policy type issues, a pastor should preach always in the name of Jesus. A politician shouldn't. Because by inference, he's saying, well, if you're not a Christian, you don't have to follow that. Okay? I think we need to have the wisdom to be able to say, whatever your faith tradition, the family is really important to you. There's social science evidence, there's the ancient history, and the different religious faiths all concur. I think that's the way a republic operates, and it's a good thing, in my opinion. So what I think we're doing is we're not bowing the knee of politics and the church. We're calling on them to be good nursing fathers in a friendly separation, true sphere sovereignty. And I think we have sometimes confused all sorts of things in this area. When I speak out as a pastor, I should never be speaking for a party, but I ought to be speaking for the values that make up parties and hope that I can influence all the parties for good. No, it was just another thing. I mean, here...
It was salt in the wounds.
It was another expression of Anglo leadership over the colonies. We're going to put our church and our leaders over you, whether you want it or not, because we can. And they were already angry enough. It's amazing, as I've read, and of course I haven't read enough, but to the extent I've read the early writings of this era, the Stamp Act, it's phenomenal how everybody rose up instantly and said, this is wrong. They said, this is unconstitutional. Under the Magna Carta, we are citizens, and nobody can put a tax on us unless we vote or have our representatives vote, and no one's asked us.
There was actually a town meeting up in Boston. I remember going through one of the archives and looking at a piece of paper. It said, "We have as much right to pass a tax on England as they do on us. So let us tonight put a tax on London and ask them to pay us." I thought that was brilliant. I said, wow. They instantly knew their constitutional rights and said, stop. The church issue, they'd been fighting bishops for ages. And they were willing, sometimes they were dissenters under the Anglican Church. They didn't want it. And if it had happened, they would have struggled, but they would have learned to live with it. But they saw that as part of the religious battle that they had to fight. But this was now coming down to the fundamental rights of what it meant. And they saw it very clearly, as one of our Supreme Court's justices has said, the right to tax is the power to destroy. The power to tax is the power to destroy. The power to tax without representatives makes you a slave. They can just keep raising it up. And that's what they did. If you don't like the newspaper and what it's saying about the king, raise up the tax. Or put him in jail. Didn't pay the tax. I can't afford to. Tough. No newspaper. Free speech is gone. So they were profoundly well educated. Just another story on this. If you've ever read the Federalist Papers, you realize it's tough going. And there's a story where a law school professor asked one of his classes to read the Federalist Papers. And they came back the next session and said, "Why in the world are you making us read this opaque, old-fashioned stuff? This is hard reading." And the law school professor said, "It's easy. I just wanted you to know what American farmers were reading back in the 1700s. So part of our problem in America is the dumbing down of our culture, which is an expression of denying the kind of self-government that comes from the heritage that we have as Presbyterians, that we have a high calling to love God with our minds, and that American citizens ought to be able to know when their father's acting like a good father or not and saying, what's wrong with you? Today we almost think like if you know about politics, there's something wrong with you. Well, that's the downside of the Pietist movement. That was the good side that gave us the Great Awakening. It stripped some of our cultural duties from us. So, well, it is a tension. There's a movement, and forgive me, I didn't make this up. You may think I made it up. There's a movement that Philip Shaw, the great church historian from Union Theological Seminary and also in Mercersburg, Pennsylvania, a German Reform scholar, addressed, and he said there is the wicked infidelity of the liberal movement that is surfacing in America. And he describes it. He calls it liberalism. And liberalism was the desire to strip God's name from all of culture, to change laws that reflect respect for the church, to require churches to pay taxes to the state. And today, you know, you go down the list of that, and you take a look at that, and then you go to like the United Churches of Christ, which would be the church that Schaff was in, and that's their program. And the course of three generations, what he called a godless infidelity, called liberalism, is now the marching orders of that church. And so we need to realize that we're living in a day where the idea of tax exemption is being used as an idea, well, you owe us something. I think we need to go back and say, that's always been the American way, that the churches should be left alone to exercise their freedom. You don't make a child pay for the father. The father pays for the child in day-to-day life. Why are you trying to make us? We're good for you. All the evidence is that people who go to church live longer. They're healthier, have stronger families. They create educational institutions. They create public service. They get voluntary movements. They do all kinds of good stuff. The armies, that's one of the great things of Philadelphia, too, is that we've seen this, like it or not, the whole debate about faith-based initiatives was born here in Philadelphia, and it has to do with saying, let the churches be free to do what they do, and the government can never touch what they do. So the tax exemption status should not be a manipulation of the church. It should be a recognition that the church is free to do it. So I think we need to turn it around and say, no, that doesn't mean you just keep your hands off of us and let us do the good stuff we've always done. Well, the powers that be want to take that away and want to tax the church. Why should we care about it? Not because we're going to take away some of our offering money. No. The power to tax is the power to destroy. We yield that ground. We are basically said we are now an institution, an engine of the government, and they will do what they want with us. We need to say, keep your hands off us. For your good and our good, we're both better. Now, the argument that James Madison used in his memorial about the teachers of religion said, true religion doesn't need a penny from the government. If it takes it, it will corrupt it. I'd like to turn around the other way. True government doesn't need a penny from the church. If it takes it, it will corrupt the government. That's the logic I would see. We need to argue for the independency of the church and state as cooperative organizations. I think it was twofold. One is that it was the way it had always been done. The Constantinian solution was ancient by the time the Reformation came along. But also, do you remember when Luther addresses what he calls the Babylonian captivity of the church? He says, the church has built up three walls around itself that make sure it can never be reformed. There's no way to reform the church. They won't call a future council. They won't address themselves with any kind of discipline. And so Luther's approach was said, we have to call the magistrate. They're the only ones left that have the authority to call the church to come back to some kind of sanity. And so it was inherent, as he saw it, if you're really going to bring the church to its knees, you had to have the state working with you. And that was not only Constantinian, but it was now pragmatically understood. And Luther appealed to it. Calvin appealed to it. Zwingli appealed to it. Everybody did. And so did the Anabaptists until they got a black eye and they said, we don't need it. And, you know, they discovered that the Gulag Archipelago can come down from jail cells. The church taught that from the beginning. It's not because you have power of the state. It's you have the power of the kingdom in your heart. You know, you don't have to have the power of government to make a reformation. But the corollary to that is, why go back to the catacombs to learn that lesson when you still have some measure of free expression of your power in the state and civil life? So that's what acquiescence to the cultural debacle is by not doing anything. We go back to the catacombs. We still have that power now. Why not use it from the remaining commanding points of culture we have left? You know, the commanding heights of culture have been totally forfeited to the secular worldview, except for the family, which is just about the last bastion we have left, and it's getting ready to be pushed off.